Good morning. All right. One of the things you realize when you're looking at cheating in baseball is that the team builders, the managers, the general managers today, but back in the day, the managers and the owners were as fanatical about winning as the players, and they would look for any opportunity, just like the players, to gain an advantage. And today we're going to talk about the temptations that were offered by the farm system. So I think any story of the front office always seems to start with the reserve clause. And this presentation is no different. As you all know, the reserve clause was that piece of a player's contract that effectively tied him to the team forever. And it was originally put in place, not surprisingly, to keep down salaries. But it had this ancillary effect of allowing teams to control good young players for as long as they wanted. And not surprisingly, this required at least some nominal safeguards for the player. So there were really four safeguards that were instituted to protect players from the reserve clause once it was in place. And the first was the Major League Minor League Draft, which today sort of survives as the Rule 5 draft. And what this allowed teams from higher leagues to draft players from lower leagues. And you need to remember that at the time, before the farm system, minor leagues were completely independent, and if you were in Peoria and a fan, you wanted your team to win just as much as people in Boston or Philadelphia wanted their teams to win. And so there wasn't necessarily an incentive other than money to allow a player to move from Peoria up the chain. And so this Major League Minor League Draft was so that players could move up the chain. There were waiver rules, right? So you couldn't be sent down to a lower league without first being offered to the other teams in your league. There were roster limits. Even when these first came in the 1890s and early 20th century, there were roster limits. And then there was what was called the optional assignment, which still is technically around today. And this was the formal mechanism for farming a player out. You couldn't just take a player and stick him in a lower minor league. You had to have this formal agreement called an option agreement in which the team would send the player down and then have the right to buy him back later at some price, so that the minor league team was getting paid for this opportunity. So issues around this first started popping up in the 1890s. John Brush owned the Indianapolis team, and he owned in the Western League, and of course he owned the Cincinnati Reds, and he was a master at this. So what he did is he drafted players from, as Cincinnati, he drafted players from the Western League, and then he would either keep them in Cincinnati or he would send them to his Indianapolis team in the Western League, which of course made the Indianapolis team then went on to win several pennants with teams that Brush had taken from their competitors. Not surprisingly, Ben Johnson, who was the president of the Western League, did not really like this, and the two of them, he and Brush, then had this enmity for the rest of their lives. Other teams talked about similar plans, and by 1903, you had the national agreement. So you basically, between the Association of Minor Leagues, the American League, and the National League, you had this agreement that formalized those four protections from earlier. So this was now much more formalized than just sort of the National League theoretically protecting the players. And this cartoon, that's John Brush standing there saying, "You fellas knuckle under or I'll," and then those are the minor leagues, all the people saying, "Not on your life, John T or John B, we are, the public is with us." Well, the public may have been with them, but Brush nevertheless managed to get away with all his shenanigans. So Leslie O'Connor was the secretary to Judge Landis for pretty much Judge Landis's whole time in office. And he talked about sort of this, the farm system, the idea that major league teams controlled minor league teams. And he said, "There are probably 5 or 10 rules that are likewise avoided by the farm system. I could give them to you if I went through the book, but I do not think there is any necessity for doing it, because that is the fact, and there are very many rules that can be evaded by farm systems." And there were sort of these proto-farm systems in the early 20th century, between about 1900 and 1920. And the way that you technically sort of avoided the rules was through something called covering up. And the definition of covering up was that the ostensible employer of the player would not be his real employer. He would be held for the benefit of another club. An early example was John Hayden, who was a player on Brooklyn. Brooklyn was managed by Ned Hanlon, the Hall of Fame manager, who also happened to own the Baltimore team in the Eastern League. And what would happen is that every spring, Hanlon would be on the Baltimore team, and then Brooklyn would buy him as a reinforcement in midsummer for $1,800. The next spring, they would theoretically sell him back to Baltimore for $1,800, but there was actually no cash ever changing hands because there was this sort of common ownership, and he was just being funneled up and down basically illegally, and they had this unfair control of John Hayden. And so the National Commission, up until Landis, theoretically was in charge of protecting players. You know, as the National Commission was the American League president, Ben Johnson, the National League president, whoever it happened to be that year, and then Gary Herman, who was the owner of the Cincinnati Reds, and they were not very sympathetic to the players. And even when the fact set was very much in favor of the players, they pretty much just sided with the teams. But Landis didn't feel that way. Landis was in no way beholden to the owners, and he was very happy to side with the players. And less than a year after taking office, he made six players free agents in October 1921. And what the violation here was that these teams, Brooklyn, Boston, and Detroit, just signed these players and then stuck them in the minors. There was no option agreement. They were not added to the roster limits. This was clearly just teams acting capriciously, and Landis made these players free agents. The other one here that I have up on the screen wasn't really all that important, but it does symbolize a couple of things. So he freed two Yankee farmhands. He made them free agents. Basically, Ed Barrow, the GM of the Yankees, had two players at Vernon. He was running out of options, so he just released the players to Vernon, so they were technically controlled by Vernon. But then there was these telegrams that Barrow was sending around offering to trade the players. So clearly he felt he still controlled them. The Oakland team and the PCL complained about this, and Landis investigated, which highlights a couple things. One is that Landis would do something if he caught him, but he had no investigative staff. And the way many of these were caught was either a team complained about a competitor or the player himself complained about how he was treated. So Landis explained his rationale for freeing the six players. First of all, other major league teams were deprived of a chance to acquire them. The players were deprived of their right to advance. The optional assignment limitations were skirted. At times, you could only have eight players out on option. So clearly, these were valuable rights. The evasion of the 40-man roster limit. And then, just sort of generically, all teams must have confidence in the validity of the rights of the players they are trying to acquire. Well, this was going on pretty much throughout the 1920s, when teams did have some relationships with other teams. Wilbert Robertson, the colorful owner of, the president and manager of the Dodgers. Paul Richards, who later became famous as a manager and general manager, was a prospect of Class D. There was a draft meeting. The Browns claimed Richards. Wilbert Robertson said, you can't do that. When Landis asked why, Robinson said, because Brooklyn has him covered up. So you could see that this was generally widespread, and if Landis could find it, he'd do something about it. One of the more interesting cases came not too far after. It was the Rick Farrell case in 1928. Farrell was originally signed by Detroit and assigned to Kinston. Detroit ostensibly released his rights to Kinston, who then sold him to Columbus for $2,000. Columbus put him on their reserve list, but he secretly was still owed to Detroit. Detroit still had first dibs on the player. So Detroit got him off of their list, and Kinston technically controlled him. Landis freed Farrell, made him a free agent. Actually, Farrell complained, and Landis investigated, and Farrell signed for $20,000 with the Browns and went on to a Hall of Fame career. And Landis, at this point, was pretty tired of all this stuff and instituted a $500 fine for the cover-ups, which of course didn't really stop anybody. And the first case against Landis, for his first suit against Landis relative to his authority as a commissioner, came out of a farm decision. So that's a picture of Phil Ball. Phil Ball in the late 1920s also controlled Tulsa, Wichita Falls, and the Milwaukee franchise. The Browns surrendered their option to Fred Bennett in 1928 to Tulsa. It was clear from the actions that St. Louis still controlled them. In one case, the Pirates offered $10,000 to Wichita Falls for Bennett, and the Wichita Falls team said no, and then later he was sold back to the Browns for $5,000. So clearly the Browns still had some sort of control over this, the player. Well, again, Bennett complained, and Landis investigated and declared Bennett a free agent, and Ball sued, basically saying that Landis did not have jurisdiction to do this, that as a commissioner, he didn't really have the right to free players. The federal judge ruled for Landis, not necessarily on the merits of the case, but just on the fact, which were fairly clear in their own right, but just on the basis of that Landis did in fact have jurisdiction, which should have helped even more sort of people stop cheating. But this was really, really widespread at the time. Here's just a bunch of examples. There was this, one of the ways that people did, the teams did this, is there was this secret refunding of checks. So Cleveland GM Billy Evans, one of the first GMs, he had a player at Decatur. He released the player on option to Decatur, who paid Evans and Cleveland $100. But it later came out that Evans secretly refunded that, paid $100 back to Decatur, and technically still controlled him. Interestingly enough, during the investigation, Cleveland Evans said he maintained the absolute integrity of that transaction, which, of course, it wasn't. Similar shenanigans between Washington, Clark Griffith. And what's interesting is these are all the owners that we sort of respect today, GMs. One of the things that he was doing with Birmingham is that Birmingham secretly funded some money up to Clark Griffith. Griffith then bought two players, one from Mobile and one from Atlanta, who were also both in the Southern Association. And then he sent those players to Birmingham. So effectively, Birmingham and Washington took two players off of Birmingham's competitors and brought them over to Birmingham. Barney Dreyfus in Pittsburgh was doing this with the Indianapolis club, where they were transferring players but then secretly sending checks back and forth. Connie Mack was doing this with Harry Killalay in Milwaukee. And what they were doing is they would transfer a player and then they would refund with a personal check. So the main check would go through the league office, and then a personal check would be used to refund the money, and so whoever was actually controlling the player would be the other team. Branch Rickey was always trying to get around the rules, probably as much as anybody. And Landis freed catcher gets Mancuso. What happened is that Mancuso, his 2 years of options expired, and Rickey just sent him down to the Rochester team, which he also controlled. So effectively, he continued to control Mancuso even after his options expired. Larry McPhail in Cincinnati was using his scouts to sign players and then put him in minor league teams, similar to what Landis had freed players for a couple years before. Sly Slatnicka, the GM in Cleveland, was another sort of mass violator, and he was used Buffalo to cover up Mike McCormick, who was later made a free agent by Landis. Slatnicka illegally signed Bob Feller, as many of you know the story. He used a minor league front team to sign Feller. At the time, major league teams could not sign high school free agents. Only minor league teams could sign high school free agents. Landis did not, as you know, make Feller a free agent. Basically, Feller and his dad did not want to be free agents, made a free agent for some reason. And then secondly, by the time that Landis ruled, the major league owners had changed the rules so that, in fact, you could use a minor league team to front for you, so that the violation seemed a little bit less. And then he also, Slapnicka also had Tommy Henrich in Milwaukee and was covering him up. Landis made him a free agent. Henrich went on to sign with the Yankees as a free agent for $20,000 and went on to a fairly successful career there. So with all this going on, Landis wanted to try and define what working agreements really meant. It is not an agreement covering reacquisition of a club's own players or players it has transferred outright. It is simply an agreement whereby a lower classification club gives a higher club a right or option to purchase or select player contracts of the lower club, not players held, transferred, or placed there by a higher club, similar to what Rickey did with Mancuso, in consideration of payment of a certain sum. So in 1938, a Branch Rickey had this wholesale cheating exposed. So what he did is he created a shadow farm system. He used the Cedar Rapids Class A team. He gave them some money, and they created a minor league relationships with teams in minor leagues. Well, Ricky in St. Louis had the relationships with those teams as well. So effectively, Ricky controlled two teams in a bunch of minor leagues, of low minor leagues, which was a very much a no-no at the time. In March of 1938, Landis declared 74 players free agents. This included Pete Reeser, who was by far the best of the players released. And, you know, Landis hoped that the release of these players would be sufficient to deter future actions. But as we have seen, nothing was sort of deterring these general managers at this time. And in 1940, sort of the hammer came down on Jack Zeller. And Jack Zeller was the GM of Detroit, and this was probably sort of the most egregious cheating that was uncovered. So he controlled more than one team in various minor leagues through under-the-table financial agreements. He pressured minor leagues to send him checks. So if he had a player on option somewhere, and then he released that player, so he was then technically the property of the minor league. When that team, then if the player was drafted from that team, Zeller would pressure that minor league club who he had a relationship with to send him part of the draft fee. He acknowledged in writing that Detroit would support Roswell, the team, with players. He wrote to them, "You will notice that no reference is made to our sending you a complete club, as that conflicts with some of the rules. However, be assured that they will be there on or before April 15th. So, you know, I think this violates clearly the number one rule of cheating, which is don't put it in writing. And then he was also just sort of arbitrarily canceling option agreements and moving players from one reserve list to another. So Landis really came down at this point. So 91 players were declared free agents. The biggest two were Roy Cullenbein and Benny McCoy. There was actually 92 players declared free agents, and you can't see it because I just sort of copied some of the names, but in the top, in that list, under the Detroit club, one of the players listed there is Dizzy Trout, and a couple of days later, Landis allowed Detroit to keep Trout, and that, I mean, obviously that would have been even more of a big deal. The Tigers were left only 78 players in their entire organization after this. 14 players who were not made free agents because they were controlled by other clubs, Detroit at that time. Detroit had to pay them nearly $50,000. And then the White Sox and Browns were actually fined for tampering. They went and approached the Cullenbein and McCoy before they were actually free agents, while they were still technically controlled by Detroit, and Landis said, "You can't do that," and fined both those teams for tampering. Well before the cases of today's, you know, in free agency. So at this point, Landis decided that he was going to come down, and he issued an edict very similar to what Rob Manfred issued in September of 2017 after the Red Sox Apple Watch scandal, where he basically said that the owners and the GMs, you guys are going to be held accountable for cheating. And so here's what he said. He said, "Notice is hereby given all clubs, club officials and employees, that the evils of common control of player dealings of two clubs in the same league and perversion of working agreements for the wholesale covering up of players must cease, and that all club officials and employees found to be involved in any such misconduct after this date will be placed on the ineligible list." That's the Joe Jackson list. John Cappellella, the GM of the Braves, was placed on that list, although he's since been reinstated. But this is that very small list of players that are banned. Obviously, you know, Manfred was only banning people for, you know, suspending people for a year. But clearly, this was the way that Landis thought he would end it. Maximum fines will be imposed on each club concerned, and all players mishandled therein will be declared free agents. And in fact, by this point, the incentives around the rules of the farm system had changed a little bit, changing the nature of cheating. But in any case, this really did finally put an end to it. So let me conclude by saying that the farm system clearly added a new way that teams could be built, but it also added a new way that teams could cheat. Thank you. I think we have time for a few questions.
Dan, you didn't cover this in this in the scope of yours, but wasn't about 10 years later in the 1950s with the bonus babies rule, which was intended to deter teams from signing amateur free agents to big contracts. Isn't it the case that they eventually decided to do away with the bonus baby rules because everybody knew, even though it wasn't written down, everybody knew that teams were flouting it, right, by making secret under the table payments, by, you know, signing a guy for a small amount, but then hiring his dad as a
right.
scout, you know, for $50,000 right. a year. That kind of, isn't that true that it was the bonus baby rule was yet another example of this kind of the violation of the bonus baby rule were what caused it to be rescinded?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that baseball really had a choice for the bonus baby rule of either increasing the penalties to actually sort of deter people the same way Landis or Manfred did, or like they eventually did, they went to the draft, right? It took them 15 years to figure out to go to the draft, but, you know, eventually they solved that problem by the draft because they were unwilling to put in the draconian penalties you really would have needed to stop that.
Yeah, maybe taking that a little bit further, do you see Landis's actions as for lack of a better term, attempting to systematize or centralize the control of the minors or, you know, that player relationship as they would move up or not to the commissioner's office versus amongst a, you know, group of, you know, squabbling owners who attempt to cover up whatever they can at any given time to try to make it sort of a single enterprise or not? Is that not mature enough at this point?
I don't think it was mature enough at that point. Landis really had no staff other than Leslie O'Connor and a couple mm-hmm. of other people. So I don't think he was really trying to systematize. Landis hated the farm system. He just believed it was really unfair to the players, and it was and it destroyed competition in the minor leagues, which in fact was true. And so he was really looking for any way to sort of put something in the farm system. He didn't believe that based on his authority, his jurisdiction, he could actually just by default end it. So I think it was more of trying to fight back against the farm system than any sort of central organization. I mean, Landis, he didn't really want to have to work too hard, right? I mean, he just kind of liked being there. So I think he felt like he probably had enough power. He just didn't feel like he'd get rid of the farm system.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks.
Yeah, John. Great presentation, Dan. The average knowledgeable fan probably will tell you that Branch Rickey invented the farm system. How did that reputation come about?
Well, in all fairness to Ricky, he really did create the farm system as we know it today in many ways. In the early 20s, he really started creating these working agreements with lots of teams. Before that, it was before the Federal League War in 1914, you weren't actually allowed to have this relationship with a minor league team. So it was all sort of done surreptitiously under the table. And by the time Ricky started doing it, he was really the first one to systematize it, and he really did start the modern farm system.
Okay.
Maybe a little off topic, but I heard one time that the Topps Gum Company used to sign high school kids one after another for $100 or so, and then if they made it, they would have them tied up for their gum company for baseball cards. Was there any ever truth in any of that?
I think that's the case. I see my Mark Armour back there, who probably knows this better than anybody, and I think, you know, check with him. They certainly tied players up young for a long time without much money, and it was Marvin Miller who actually got the money to start the union by telling the players to hold out for more and hold out longer and increase that. So I think it's definitely true.
Thank you.
Thank you.